Hi, this is Marion Nessel. I'm the Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University and a longtime fan of Heritage Radio.
Like Marion, you too can support Heritage Radio Network, a member-based nonprofit radio station operating out of Bushwick, Brooklyn.
I've been on it countless times. I love being interviewed. The interviewers are always really well prepared and fun to talk to about the issues that matter to me the most, about how we can change our food system to one that's healthier for people and the environment. It's just invaluable to have an independent radio station that's dealing with these issues. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful asset.
Support Heritage Radio Network by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Well, hello and welcome. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton and welcome to Chef Story. And today we're broadcasting from Seoul, Korea. I happen to be here for Seoul Gourmet and I am really thrilled because I am presenting along with some of the world's greatest chefs. And I made an extraordinary discovery. I met Wojciech Modest Amaro, who has a one-star Michelin. He's the only Michelin-starred chef in Poland, in Warsaw. And after I saw his demo, I realized he has to be one of the most creative and wonderful chefs we have working in the world today. And so, Wojciech, I am so excited to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Let's do a shout-out to New York.
Yes. Hello, New York.
Hello. So we can't wait. We want you to come and do a pop-up.
But I will do. I will come.
I have to say, just to give people, because they may not be that familiar with you or your restaurant, let me tell the public out there what turned my head about you. First of all, Wojciech's cuisine is so close to the earth and the seasons. We're going to get into that later. Even Dan Barber asked for his calendar that we're going to talk about. But I saw something yesterday that I never saw before. And you were going to cure a piece of salmon.
Yeah.
And you did it. You said, I wanted to do it as naturally as possible. And you thought about the sweetness of carrots. And so you grated probably 10 pounds of carrots and put a little salt with it and kept it in a big plastic bag to sort of get the juices out.
Yeah.
And that's what you used to cure the salmon. With this one piece of beautiful fillet of salmon, you covered it in this carrot, just this grated carrot compote, I guess. It wasn't cooked at all. It was absolutely raw. Only for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And it cured the salmon. And I thought, I have never seen anything. That is really looking at the earth and taking the earth. I was so excited. You had also put fennel seeds on the salmon, I would say. But we'll get into that later. But you are truly a man of the earth. That's what I can believe. So welcome.
Thank you so much. Yes.
So tell me, Wojciech, where exactly in Poland did you grow up, and what were some of your earliest influences about food?
I come actually from south of Poland, very urban, area, and actually it's hard to believe that you could be somehow interested in cooking at that point in Poland, but my childhood was that we were we were not rich at all. We were kind of poor, and my parents used to take us for a full 2 months during summer holidays to our family in the countryside, in the middle of Poland, and we spent the 2 months. And I can recall this is my first memories of food, of ingredients, of this, you know, unique garden that we used to walk into and touch everything, the carrot, the gooseberries, I remember, of course, and the apples and raspberries, and we used to wash it everything under the water pump, yeah, and just eat like that, completely raw. I used to go fishing with my brother. We were stealing our uncle's motorcycle, whatever. not grow enough to ride it, but we were doing that, and also working on the field. So you know, it was like as happy childhood as you can imagine. You know, completely free with wonderful ingredients and fantastic food. But I think this is the moment when my alphabet, I would say, of flavors, you know, it start to set up in my mind. I like to take and taste something that is as original as possible. So I can tell now that it took me a long time to go to the to Japan for the first time, because I want to try also the sushi at the place when the origin is of that. So I have this kind of patience to wait to taste the, you know, the original flavors as they should be served or existed. And I think that was my first encounter with ingredients itself. And then I found kitchen altogether the most interesting place in my house.
You grew up in an urban place, yeah, in southern Poland. So what would your was there a lot of canned food, or was there a lot
of... The food was very good. My mother was he's very good cook, but you know, it's my father was a pilot. He used to work for Red Cross. Uh-huh. He was, we can say, he was saving lives of many people.
That's
children,
a great
thing mainly
to do.
In the mountains as well, on helicopters. So it's quite, you know, risky as well, profession.
In Poland, what would be your breakfast?
By then we used to, I remember always we used to have a fantastic bakeries, and the bakery was there. Maybe there was not as many ingredients to choose from to put on the slice of bread, but decent butter and fantastic breads that were available. You know, we have to remember, we're talking about communism era in Poland, you know, completely 50 years of blackout. When all the traditions were wiped out, basically, people were just trying surviving. So the food was just the fuel, probably, to live on. And people from countryside were more lucky because they had small farms and many ingredients. So for us, it was like this. You waited 10 months for those 2 months of vacation. It was, and every year was the same. We couldn't wait to go there again for another 2 months.
So to get the bakery bread, did you have to wait online? Was there enough food for people?
No, it was until I don't know how you call it, the military time when army was in charge of everything in 1981, I guess, 13th of December.
So did you have a lot of meat? Did you have a lot of fish?
We used to go to my father's family in the mountain, which was not that far, 2-3 hours drive. And they had, of course, so we could get a very good sausage and pieces of meat and free, we would say now, free-range chicken and eggs and everything. But living in a city was difficult, obviously, and the choice was very limited. And when we had this, the military time, There was basically no food. The shelves were empty completely, and people were queuing for hours to get, I don't know, a piece of butter, salted butter at that time, I remember, wrapped in a newspaper. So it was quite difficult. So even more, you know, this willingness of going to the countryside when there was still plenty to choose from. It was like awakening.
Were there restaurants when you were growing up?
Restaurant, we used to call it the Milky Bars.
The Milky Bars?
Yes. They were serving simple soups, maybe a few pancakes or pierogies stuffed with cottage cheese and a little bit of sugar. That's it. So and restaurants, whoever was the member of the Communist Party, they of course they were the better ones, and they had more privileges and they used to go, and more money probably, to go to some kind of restaurants, and it was this classic Polish cuisine based on, you know, breaded pork chops and some potato cabbage and things like that. But you know, I would say if you write down the menu from those years, it would be like 10 dishes altogether, all over.
So the culture of being a chef was not something.
Was not completely. I remember when I was finishing my primary school and I was choosing the college, I said to my parents, "I want to go to culinary college," and they were just completely shocked. and it was a disaster. It was a family disaster because my grades in at school were all perfect, and I had, you know, this special award when I completed the school as the one of the
top
best ever. And imagine sitting down with your parents and telling them you're gonna be a cook, when, you know, being a cook, being a chef, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't sound any interesting.
It's not professional.
It's not a professional. It's for people who don't know what to do
blue
with
collar,
their lives. Yeah.
What made you want to be a chef? I mean, it wasn't that you had exciting restaurants.
No, I think it was this love for food, for ingredients that was with me. When I was three, I did my first, we could say, kind of souffle.
You were three?
Yeah, and I asked my sister, she was 3 years older, to actually light up the oven, the gas oven, because I couldn't touch the matches, of course. I would be, you know, it would be
You did listen to your parents sometime.
So
how did you know about a souffle when you were three?
I don't know, I just saw it, and I wanted to beat one egg whites and in the other bowl mix one the egg yolk with sugar and add it to that and just purely, you know, bake it quickly and eat it. And so that was my first account of my first dish ever, I guess. And then I was always, you know, around the kitchen during, you know, Sunday was at that time, you know, this special day, not only the day of, but also parents used to save something extra for the Sunday meal for a whole family. So I was always there, and we used to cook with my mother all kind of cakes, pastry. I love that. I thought actually at the beginning I'm gonna be the pâtissier.
What did your friends think? Your parents are really upset because you're brilliant,
yeah,
and they want you to be
someone.
Well, you know, doctor, lawyer, whatever. Yeah. And what did your friends think when you said you wanted? Did they look down on the chef profession or?
I don't think I actually shared that, you know, that passion for cooking with anyone. I used to just be a normal boy at that age. We used to play a lot of football, and my second passion, I would say, in love was with tennis. So I spent hours at the tennis court, and I, if somebody asked me and I had the proof that I play a lot, I used to say, yeah, I'm going to be a tennis player one day. But deep in my heart, I knew.
You knew you wanted to be a chef. So was there a culinary school that was?
There was a culinary school even in my town in Sosnovyj, but you know, it sounded so terrifying to my parents. And my father, I think he's a very wise man. He asked me to sit down and to have a little chat about it. And actually he told me everything about being a cook. He rolled up my full career in front of me at that point to see what I am getting into. And then convinced me, just, you know, as father can do to his loving son, that, you know, what other choices are there. And I changed my mind after that, and I went to electronic college, because there was the best college in the area, I think in top three altogether in the whole country, and there's something that sounded like a really future for a young boy, the technical college specializing in electronics or whatever that means. And with that, you know, note that the grade that I had, the paper that I had from the college, it was, you know, the right direction. So we decided that I will give it a try. And I passed the exams. There were three exams. I passed two, and because the notes were as high as possible, then I didn't have to go to the third one. I was already approved. So everybody was really hoping that, you know, he's coming a brilliant career in electronics for me. Until I reached the first lesson, and during the holidays, I pumped up the balloon of expectation and, you know, my future beautiful life, being this technician and so on. And the first lesson when we enter, a professor asked me and a friend of mine to bring some equipment from the back of the room, and we were carrying this. It weighed 50 kilo, and it was one of the electronic devices that used to have at that time.
No microchip.
There was no electronics, no computer or nothing like that. It was
what
so
year was
odd.
This?
And you know, all my balloon of expectations just was blown away within a second. My first hour at school, and I knew what a mistake.
Oh my gosh!
And of course, my marks went down completely from that on, and half year at the half year at school, I had a chat again with my father, because they were not happy, you know, with my performance.
Yes.
I was completely not interested in electronics, but I was still playing tennis. So we decided that you have to complete some college anyway. So why don't you play tennis and, you know, just use a little energy, as little as you can, to finish the college. It's like somebody will give you 5 years of freedom at this age. I was extremely happy with that.
Wow.
About that deal. And I did play tennis, and you know, I was cooking at times.
Where were you cooking? At home?
At home, in my grandmother's house, and you know, spontaneously at friends' places, like really hiding the passion for cooking in front of them.
So tell me, so you continued at the electronics college for five years?
Yes, I complete that. At the end, I passed all the exams, the final exams. I used this little bit of energy and you know, I play smart to learn what I had to learn at the end, and I passed the exams, and then I was facing the fact that I have to go to do military service, which was really scary.
Whoa.
After 5 years of freedom.
Right, in tennis.
How can you go?
So every man has to do military
service?
For how long?
For 2 years.
2 years,
yeah.
Okay.
So, and the only thing that could save you actually was, you know, going as everybody to university. Yeah. So I did choose the university. And as one of my mentors used to say, it was all so close with cooking. So I choose the political science to study at the Silesia University, just to be safe from the army. And you know, when I started my first summer holidays, I went to London to visit my sister. She had been already there for 3 years, so it was a good opportunity to visit her finally. But deep in my heart, I knew that I am running away finally, you know, to enter the kitchen and to start what I, you know, my dream job to become a chef. And I had to face this phone call to my mother, which my mother worked at the Silesia University, so she was completely embarrassed when I contacted her after summer holidays, and I said on the phone, "I'm not coming back. I found my my place. I'm working in the kitchen. I am extremely happy, and I couldn't be happier. And definitely, I won't be continuing the university.
Was it a communist time then?
No, it was already.
Okay,
no.
So you were free to.
Yeah,
leave.
I was free to go and to do that. But I can say after many years, I think she forgave.
She forgave you. Okay, we're going to take a quick break here, and we'll be right back.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market, America's healthiest grocery store with more than 400 locations throughout the United States. Download the Whole Foods Market app on your smartphone for recipes, sales, information, and digital coupons. Or visit WholeFoodsMarket.com to find a store closest to you.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story. It's Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and my guest today is Wojciech Modest Amaro from Atelier Amaro in Warsaw. We're sitting in Seoul, Korea, and in a beautiful restaurant where he's cooking tonight, and I can't wait. You're at the beginning of your culinary career. You started in London. Well, what was your first culinary job?
My first culinary job was an Italian place. And if you have this, you know, fixed idea about becoming a chef and you're sort of dreaming about being in the kitchen and cooking wonderful dishes, and then of course suddenly arrives the first job. So
I can see it coming.
You know, my first job, 8 months, no day off.
That's illegal.
Just in case you want to change your mind and, you know, find out what are you getting into. It was eight months. And at that point, I had no work permit in UK because Poland wasn't a member of European Communion. And so, you know, that's the choice. And people were treating, I would say, us just like that at that time. But I approved that. I said, of course, that's what I came for. So I was working with very old Italian chef who used to be a head chef for many years at San Lorenzo on Knightsbridge, a very prestigious restaurant when even the Queen used to visit. And he was about 86, and he had like a part-time job. So he was coming to set up the menu, to teach us, you know, a few dishes. And and do working only 3 days a week for a few hours. So that when I started, you know, all the grating parmesan and, you know, peeling and grilling, whatever, making pasta, which I love until now, that was all my beginning. And after 8 months, he actually died. But before it happened, he kind of found this, I think, this talent in me. He gave me his set of knives.
Oh my!
And if you open the drawer, you can see some of the knives or spatula. They're like 30, 40 maybe years old. So old. And I traveled quite a lot after that. And, you know, all the time I traveled. So in the end, I kind of lost during those flights and, you know, different countries, some of those knives. I still have the spatula. And it was like really very touching moment, even when I think about it now. And then I thought, I have the basics. I have to, now I can conquer the world. I can conquer the London.
How long were you in that restaurant?
I was for 8 months. And when he died...
Wait, I just have to ask you, the Queen came to dinner there?
No, he used to be a chef. He used to be a head chef of one of the best restaurants.
I wondered
before.
If the Queen went to restaurants.
And the part-time, it was just, you know, after he retired, he was just, you know, an active person, not you know, not to sit at home, but keep working all his life. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, I'm ready now to, you know, to conquer London. And my next job was... kind of posh place at that time, Cafe Montpelliano in the middle of Knightsbridge in front of Harrods, with that basic skills that I learned from him, you know, I could do that. But then I realized that I have to do something else. So, you know, my first, I would say 3-4 years was like running 300 miles per hour. I used to have two jobs. I remember I used to set up my watch, my alarm clock at, you know, like 4 a.m. to go to the city to work at the patisserie shop when they were making all the, you know, French pastry from the scratch. And the shop used to close at 1 after, you know, they've done everything, all the sandwiches, baking breads and things like that. And I used to run to another restaurant to work. I asked for any stage I could internship, I could, you know, enter, and it was like complete madness. I remember my parents coming over to London at that time, and my father just couldn't believe. I used to fall asleep on the, you know, tube. They were waking me up when they were washing cabins and things like that. I was completely tired, exhausted. I didn't know what to do.
How many hours a day?
I was working, I think. Even 18 hours a day, and for a long time, and then I found this dream job with Nigel Davis on Knightsbridge as well, Old Brompton Road. He used to call it, I will remember in a moment, and I actually sat. And Nigel Davis used to be a head chef of the Ivy in London. I think in 80s, 90s, one of the best restaurant in the world altogether. If we had the 50 best, they would have been there. And I sat on the pavement and I was waiting for him. And he passed me like several days. He didn't even look at me. And at the end, I thought, well, I until you give me a chance, I will be here. And then
you literally sat.
Yeah.
Up?
And then he asked me, what do you want? And I said, I would like to work with you. And he said, okay, come tomorrow. And it was the most outrageous story, because when I was so happy, I said, yes, of course, what time? And then I ran. And then I realized the next morning I already have an appointment. I am buying a car in Brixton. So I came back like an idiot to tell him that I cannot actually come tomorrow. Because I have a really important appointment. And he just looked at me and he said, whatever, go. And I thought it's over. But the following day I returned. and he just make a really fun of me in front of everyone. He said, oh, Mr. Amaro is here, so, you know, finally he's free to join us and all that. Yeah, but I deserve that. And I was cooking with him. He was one of the few Englishmen, British people I know that, you know, he used to work in France for 10 years, the south of France cuisine, that's what we were doing at that time. All these pig trotters with morel mushrooms and beautiful mushroom and potato puree, and, you know, all the classics. But he was so organized, he was so good at it, and the flavors were amazing. And
so was this the what you were dreaming of when you were a teenager?
I think
food, that because you hadn't tasted food like that.
And then I saved a little bit of money, and I remember going into Le Gavroche for lunch.
That's the Roux Brothers, right?
Yeah, that's the Roux Brothers. That's two-star restaurant. Yeah. And, you know, if you are Yankee, go there, you know, by yourself, because most probably you're still shaking whether you have enough money in your pocket, so you wouldn't invite anyone to go with you.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I still have the check somewhere for my first dinner at the Michelin restaurant like that. And you know, the whole story about the restaurant, like the movement,
the ballet,
the linen, you know, the ballet of it, the champagne, the amuse-bouche, and all that. I was just completely, I fall in love with that. And but I had this, I actually wanted to go to, they approved me to School of Excellence by Roux Brothers. I was going to sign a contract, and I met a senior, Albert Roux. And he actually convinced me not to join the team, which was like, it doesn't happen. If you have, even now I know that, if I found in my kitchen somebody extremely talented, I want him badly. Because, and he was just very warm and kind person to talk. What is your style? What do you think? What do you want to be in the next, 10 years? And I started to actually tell him that the truth, that, you know, repeating classic is not my cup of tea. I always, you know, create something. I always try to smuggle something, you know, into not mine dishes, or somebody else. And he just looked at me and he said, I don't think this is for you. And it was just a silence. I think you should do your own way. You're gonna be, you know, a 3-star restaurant, the Waterside Inn. You're gonna be doing a Dover sole for a whole year.
Yeah,
Veronique or whichever of the recipes, and you're gonna be sleeping with 5 New Zealanders in a tiny little room.
Yeah,
and I was like, oh my gosh. And but you know, it's.
How generous of him to say that.
Generous. So well, and experience to take this energy and this passion you have in front of you and just go a little bit further. What do you want to do?
Did he give you a suggestion what you should do?
No. He just told me, he's, I don't think you should sign with us. I don't think you should do. You find your own path. You know, it's basically probably gonna be kind of killing you, and if you follow that. And I remember when I worked with Nigel, I actually created my first chilled soup in the summer with cucumber, with some pistachios, with some, I don't even remember now what was it. But we had the review at the Evening Standard, and actually they wrote about the soup. And I remember after the Evening Standard was coming out at something like 5 p.m. in the afternoon. So after the evening service, he asked me to come to his office, and I was completely scared. What's going to happen? And he asked, when I entered, he asked me, what kind of beer are you drinking? And I was like, oh no. I didn't know what to expect or anything. Cronenberg, Stella Artois, whatever. I'm drinking Baddington, actually. And then he picked up the phone and he called the service to bring two beers. One for him, one for me. And he opened the Evening Standard and he said, in my kitchen from now on, you can do whatever you like. And he showed me the review.
Wow.
And we drank the beer. And I became a junior sous chef then. And it was just, you know, when you need luck along the way. You can do, in a kitchen, you always need to do long hours, hard work and so on. But if you find these, you know, mentors and teachers at the right time, in the right place, you know, it gives you wings and, you know, you jump into something new.
So I want to get to where you are today. How many restaurants did you work in before you decided to open your own place?
I think 20 few restaurants, because 20, 22 or 3 restaurants. Some, I think I include on my resume maybe 11 of those, because there were also restaurants that I left after 5 minutes when I was young.
So which were some of the most influential?
There were two crucial points. The first one was when I went to El Bulli, and everybody thought, or would be thinking even now, that this is about the molecular cuisine. There was nothing to do with molecular cuisine, but what I found at El Bulli was a free man standing in front of his kitchen, completely free, completely.
What made you want to go there?
I actually got the award from International Academy of Gastronomy, Chef de l'Avenir, Chef of the Future. And as a part of the award, they offered me going to El Bulli. Who would refuse that?
Yes, exactly.
Of course I'm going. But I didn't actually say that when I arrived. And Albert Adria received the same award on the same year with me. So I am entering the El Bulli, but I didn't tell anybody that I have some kind of award, whatever. You're just here to learn. You're just there going there to learn. And Ferran was just, so free to create an open mind. If you want to cook a piece of meat like carrot, he will do that. If he wants to cook a carrot like a piece of meat, he will do that as well. So there was no borders, nothing, just complete a freedom. And if you have time and your mind is open enough to try things, but then use your senses at the end to find the perfect combination of flavors, that's enough. So, and then all my life, chefs were asking me, hey, how about Polish cuisine? And I was thinking like, oh my gosh, what am I going to say? This breaded pork chops? No, this pierogies. And he asked me as well. So I remember I phoned my friends and I said, can you just make a big, box of Polish ingredients and send over to El Bulli right now? And they did that. They were like, apart from vodka, there were bison grass and, some berries, some herbs, dried herbs and all that. And I gave it to him. And he said, if you are telling the truth that you have all that, what are you going to do about it? And that was just struck me. How, if you have ingredients, how you cannot have the symphony? And I was driving back 2,500 kilometers back to Warsaw after that, and I was thinking about Polish cuisine all the time. And then in 2010, when I was just about to open, a few months away from opening Atelier, I sent my first book, Polish Cuisine of 21st Century, to René. And I think he replied after 6 months or so. And he said, who wrote this book? And I said, I did. Why don't you come over? Of course. I'm coming tomorrow morning.
To Noma.
To Noma. And I started to feel, the pressure. I invest every single penny we had and every single penny we didn't have into Atelier. and maybe I should cook, you know, a little bit for the people, how they will react if I do what I have in my heart. And he, I think, just gave me courage by also telling his true story, that when they opened Noma in 2003, you know, people were laughing at him. What are you going to do with local products? What do you mean with local products? With pigs and herrings? And you know, we don't have to say anything else. He's not the best right now. And he convinced me to do as a plan. No cutting corners, no compromising anything. Just, you know, you have to cook it from your heart. So I became a heart of Atelier Amaro.
What got you back to Poland?
There was all the time, you know, I had this fixed idea, even when I started, that I don't want to be number 3,768 in London. I want to be number one in Poland. But I was waiting for the right venue, right opportunity. And it arrived in 2003. I was chosen to be a head chef, executive chef at the Polish Business Roundtable Club, 300 richest people in Poland, private member clubs. And so you can imagine people who travel the world, they've been everywhere, they ate the best sushi, they had the best foie and caviar, and you are there to fulfill their expectation. There is 12 menus running on daily basis in the private rooms, you know. It's a challenge. It's another hectic job, you know, to take on your shoulders.
So you went back to that?
Yeah, I went back. But on the other hand, I had the ingredients anybody else in Poland could dream of. I could buy anything that I wanted. I used to drive to France, to Rungis, Intermarché, to buy things. And I remember my boss, he didn't like that. He said, I have only you. How can you drive 18 hours, buy things, and then drive 18 hours back to Poland? And I remember when there was the time of the week when I had to drive to France to buy things, and I was supposed to actually let it do somebody else. I didn't do that.
Because you wanted, you know, to pick the right things.
Walking on the, you know, on that market, it's just amazing, you know, experience for any chef, right? Choosing your ingredients and then driving back with a smile on your face. So
let me take a break here and we'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and today my guest is Wojciech Modest Amaro from Atelier Amaro in Warsaw. So, Chef, how did you open Atelier? What was the tipping point that you said, okay, I'm ready?
After 9 years, the academy, International Academy set up...
Where is the International Academy based?
In France. But they set up the branch in Poland, and they started to visit this business club, but it was just for private members. And we actually get this tip from them that if you ever dream of having a Michelin star, you have to open to the public, because... Quite frankly, we believe the quality of the food is there, but you have to, you know, you have to open to the public. And if this is a private members club, you have to convince the members. They allowed you to, you know, open a room for anybody from the street. It was a difficult part, but we did that. But 1 month after opening, my dear friend and my boss, he died very suddenly. And I, you know, this is the time of your life when you have to, you know, it's again a turning point. You had everything that people were like telling you, just open there and you're going to get the star. There's no doubt about it. And it's just all falled apart after his death. So I spent 12 months traveling across Poland. I did like 60,000 kilometers. I was saving money. I was looking for ingredients. I was looking for my philosophy. I was creating the calendar of nature, and I was, you know, talking to many people. And in the end, of course, I found this little location in the middle of park, a very small place. And I thought it's just perfect for me. It's surrounded by nature, so it has to be mine. And even though the kitchen is minus one level, very tiny, but it was just perfect. My heart was beating when I was walking through, you know, next to that building. And I decided to rent it. I put all the money, I took a loan, whatever and was necessary. And in 2011, after returning from Noma, we opened Atelier. And 3 months later, we received a Rising Star from Michelin Guide. And the Rising Star actually right now doesn't exist anymore. Michelin said that it's a little bit confusing. People don't get the idea what's the Rising, what's Michelin. So, but for us, it was the proof that we are heading into the right direction. We just have to, you know, keep on working hard. But on the other hand, I have to be honest, it was so much pressure from the media that we can become the first historical Michelin star restaurant in the country. And we start to fall apart. You know, we were feeling such a pressure about this whole Michelin thing. And I remember 1 month after the announcement, this Rising Star, we had the staff meeting, and I said, let's just forget it about all that, because nobody cares when you run marathon and you come second. So, you know, just let's don't think about the Michelin and going into history books and things like that. Let's just cook, you know, as what we're supposed to do. And we basically started just to do our thing, you know, cooking.
So tell us, you know, I think a lot of our listeners have never had the chance to taste your food. So explain what was one of your first menus, or describe a menu to us that you think are really representative of the way
There is several things. First of all, as you as chef, you travel the world, you have all these little notes from everywhere. You steal the menus. You copy the recipes, you know, you take a photo of the dishes. So it's a huge, after 22 years, you know, I had lots of that, and I needed to actually somehow make it into a proper, build a structure around it. And I thought if you keep thinking, you put your pen on the empty paper and you say, okay, what's going to be on the menu? Oh, let's take a minute. What's available now? And then you call your suppliers and you say, what do you have? Do you have this? No. So I thought, why don't I make a book that it follows it? Every year is almost the same, but the seasonality treated, you know, spring, summer, winter, autumn, winter is not enough. Some dishes last, you know, 2 weeks, some ingredients. And I started to create the calendar, divided the environment into areas as they exist: lake, sea, river, meadow, farm, forest, field, and the mountain, because they have different specifics, special also plants, special microclimate and all that. So it's 8 categories, and we start to categorize all the ingredients available in each week. And I remember when I arrived into 39 week of the year, which is kind of end of September, I listed 539 ingredients. And I remember sitting there like thinking, are we serious?
Wow.
I have in my hand one of the biggest gardens in the world, probably filled with, you know, biodiversity and all that. And Poland, you know, for people who don't know, we have the Great Lakes area, we have the mountains, we have this access to Baltic Sea, you know, it's all kind of, you can find in Poland. And that was the list of the ingredients. So imagine putting them on the table just in front of you. It's a powerful tool if you want to create dishes that never existed before. And that's how I started, actually. I had this this powerful book with those ingredients, with the dates when this something starts, when it finishes, and I was working with that and started to create my menu based on that. And then my second thought was, if I ask you right now very quickly your top five food memories or the best memories, you can come up maybe very briefly with five, but maybe you need a little bit longer time to come up with another few. It could be your grandmother cake, it could be the best fish you ate, it could be, you know, a pasta in Italy or wine. I remember Blumenthal saying that he had this fantastic seafood and he ordered a bottle of wine. It was so good and so cheap. He ordered two cases of that and he sent to his best friends in London and they opened that with the rain outside the window, you know, next to fireplace, and they called him and said, what kind of wine you send us? This is such a crap. So you have to be aware also of the situation, who you with, what's the occasion, everything gives you this memory, and I thought we're gonna call our menu moments, because this is the moment that you will remember or not. And we modestly say, if out of our eight moments, there's our biggest degustation menu, even though the moments actually is 16, amuse-bouche, pre-desserts, all that, you have the eight moments. If we will be remembered by one of these dishes throughout your life, our job is done. We don't have the tendency, and I know from my experience, if I go to places, there won't be no 15 or 28 dishes I will remember and they will wow me. There will be few. So I think if I can create this memorable experience for someone who comes to visit, that's perfect. So the menu is called The Moments. And then we just follow with the calendar of nature and Polish ingredients.
So to get back to the calendar, is the calendar a book?
It's not actually a book. It's I would like to publish one day, and I think it's kind of it should be kind of like a lifetime work.
Yes.
Because I'm filling the pages all the time, and maybe I would love to publish one day. Even in English or somewhere abroad, I don't know. But this is, you know, then we have our we experiment with things like most chefs do, even though I was very skeptic about that. I thought people who say we have the lab, oh my gosh, really? And then when we opened Atelier and we were again running at 300 miles per hour, my office was at the staircase. There is no office such a thing in my tiny little kitchen. And I thought, how can you create in the middle of such a, you know, dynamic living kitchen? I'm sitting on a staircase, I'm writing new dishes, you know, somebody's pushing me, crossing me over. And it's just, you know, I realized, this is how you can create. You need a peace of mind, peaceful place filled with equipment, and then you can start, you know, playing with that, experimenting, testing. And so 1 year after that, after opening, I found the space for the lab. Very quickly I opened that, and I also encourage my chefs, young people, to go there for a whole day without actually any goal to achieve. Just maybe take a box of tomato and, you know, you have all this super modern technology around you, and just play with it. And
how much do you use technology?
There is a motto above our door: nature meets science. And people always, it's again the science people consider it's about molecular. No, the science by dictionary, it's a knowledge obtained through study or practice. There is no molecular word in that. So if you have a farmer who grows potato for 40 years and you make him, you know, sit down and write his experience into the book, it will be a scientific book about how to grow potato, what to avoid, you know, and things like tips. So I think the practice is, you know, something that, you know, gives you the power to understand. And whoever names it a molecular cuisine, I always say, no. For me, it's conscious cuisine. You are aware. We know the sous vide, we know the temperature, now we know what's ticking behind the processes. You are using some technique because you are conscious, you are aware why and what for. So, but I think it's like, I will give you the example of wild strawberries. They are so tiny, they are so beautiful, they are so tasty. So we experiment with them. We make these foams, jellies, everything. It just doesn't work. It's a waste of fantastic ingredient. I hardly remember a year when I ate enough of wild strawberries. I want to have it in my hand, just eat it. So after all that, you just say, no, we're going to serve it as the nature gave us. And on the other hand, if you have cranberries, you cannot do the same. You cannot eat a whole handful of cranberries. It will just, you know, your head will fall apart. So then when you choose the techniques, maybe you can do a little foam that disappears in your mouth and leaves the cranberry flavor on your tongue. This is wise to use the technique then. And I think this is how we see things in terms of technology and all that. It helps us a lot. We're much better cooks, I think, as well.
Can you give me three flavors that are dominant in your menus?
Altogether, there will be a forest. 30% of Poland is forested. We are kingdom of mushrooms, wild game, venison. We are fifth producer in the world of edible herbs and flowers. So the first one has to be juniper.
Juniper?
Juniper, yeah. And the green juniper, which I love so much.
Explain that, because I don't think a lot of Americans are that familiar.
The juniper berry is the black one that you know. And you
we know it from gin.
Yeah, yes. From gin, you know it from gin. But when the berry is green and you actually turn it into kind of, we do actually oil, infuse the oil with it. And the whole experience is completely different. It's still juniper, but it has this chlorophyll green aroma, grassy kind of. If you close your eyes and you put this juniper in your mouth, you know somebody gave you something green. It's hard to explain. It's green. It's 1,000,000%. So it's completely different. We use that quite a lot. The second one will be pine. Again, some forest flavor. And I think the third one...
I think you showed something with pine, that you make a pine oil?
Yes, we make the pine oil, but we make a pesto also with pine needles when they are edible. And the third one will be hard. There's many flavors, I think. But the one Poland should be proud of, because it comes from primal, the only primal forest in Europe, it will be the bison grass. This unique
now
flavor.
Now, is bison buffalo?
People use different name. We say it's bison grass. And you have to remember the grass itself, if you actually... move your hand, move your palm of your fingers
on the leaf, on the blade.
And then if you should have the silver left on your finger. If not,
silver?
Silver is like a color.
Color? Yeah. And what is that?
That's the bison grass, the real one.
Oh, I what does bison mean?
Bison is it's a buffalo, yeah.
It is a buffalo. Yeah. Are there buffalo in...
Yeah, they are, because it's a natural park, so they are, you know, protected.
I see. So and the bison grass only grows in one area?
In that area, yeah.
And it's a primal forest, meaning it goes back to time immortal.
Yeah, yeah. Virgin forest, they say. So it should be one of the flavors associated with
so
Poland,
what is
cuisine.
What does bison grass taste like?
I think it has the... Of course, the grass is there. They are the grassy aroma, little, very tiny, citrusy, sagey kind of, but also honey flavors.
Mm.
Melissa, you know the herb. So it's
are they
a mixture of all that.
You said the grass is dead?
No.
But is it illegal to pull the grass because it's a primal forest?
I don't think I heard that question.
Oh, I finally got something new to you. Because you would think now a primal forest, it's the only place it grows?
The only place that grows.
Mm, I hope.
But even now, it's not illegal. You can, even if you enter the national park itself, in front of the park, the people are standing with little bunches of that dried.
Uh-huh.
So
nice.
I don't think it's that illegal.
Well, we're getting to the. You know, we've gone way over our allotment. We're almost at an hour, but this has been so fascinating. Tell me a little bit about. What challenges you today? You're obviously someone who's constantly looking to learn and to grow. So where do you look for that today?
I think it's kind of obligation for me or mission, we would say. That's why I'm here also in Seoul to show Polish cuisine to others. I can see from Atelier we have 60% of our customers are foreign customers.
Mm.
It's quite a lot on a weekly basis, weekend days, Friday, Saturday, no one speaks Polish upstairs in a restaurant. So, but it's like being ambassador of Polish cuisine, of something new. You wouldn't consider a Poland as a culinary direction, I guess, and it's time to change that. For me, knowing my fundamentals right now, what's really available in Poland, how big the country is and filled with wonderful ingredients, you have to go and show others. If there is a space, Latin American cuisine, if there is a space for Asian cuisine, of course, and Singapore, whatever, many different places, I just want to make a statement that we also exist. And nowadays you can travel anywhere you like and maybe find out and discover something new and exciting for yourself. And of course, every of those journeys I take also as an inspiration. I cannot bring directly in terms of copy-paste some of the techniques, ingredients, because I am using only Polish ingredients. But, the inspiration is right there. We are in Seoul. In Korea, when kimchi style is all over, we do a lot of that. Fermentation, pickling, marinating is also part of Polish cuisine and European cuisine all together. So probably I will see a few good points here and try to, include that in my future dishes or I'll be inspired by what I see here. And, in terms of progress, the progress will be, for us. I can see now 2011 when we opened, 2016 when we are right now, and we have a star. Yeah, we have the appetite for more.
For more, okay. Well, it's been great to have you on the show today, and we can't wait for you to come to New York.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I will visit. Yes, we already done the deal.
Okay, done the deal. Yeah. Pop-up's coming. Okay. Well, I'd like to thank Chef Amaro for being with us today. And I want to do a shout-out to Robin Cohen, my producer. And I want to say goodbye to Jack Inslee, who's been the producer since the beginning of Chef's Story. We wish him well, especially in his new ventures. And we'll see you in Washington, D.C., Jack. And to all our listeners, we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.